in my devotional reading, I was coming through the book of Deuteronomy again and fell upon a passage that really underscored this whole thing. And I thought, well, you know, other than just simply passing on what may or may not be relative information to you, there's a point to this whole thing. You realize that when we were addressing, and by the way, Sunday morning we're going to finish, I believe, by exposing the essential flaws in replacement theology. But having said that, I want you to understand that there are some very, very good and godly men, scholars in the Scriptures, who hold the replacement theology, and I do not wish in any way to convey to you that they have no hope in Jesus. That's not the point. But they come about their conclusions and interpretations of Scripture in a flawed manner, in my opinion. And I think that when we take into consideration the defense of Israel and the larger, bigger principle that's behind that, do you realize that when God makes a, when He utters a prophecy, He is in a sense creating, making a promise. Uttering a prophecy is to be equated with a promise that He makes. And so if God, in His covenant promises and prophecies to Abraham, is either not able to finish, or His original utterance was in which He never intended to fulfill, then basically that assaults the veracity of God, period. If God is either not able or is deceitful at the beginning and never intending to keep His covenant with Israel as He laid it out there, then a whole lot of other things are in jeopardy. One of which I think you would see as obvious is that we're all sitting here tonight at prayer meeting, and if God is not able or is unwilling or never intended to make good on His word, then we're sitting here like a gang of dummies. We might as well go down to the corner bar, live it up, eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow we die. So what? Okay. Now, I just want to illustrate before we get to the lesson here tonight that when God utters a prophecy, it is to be equated with a promise. And in a very practical way, I want you to be able to track this. Genesis chapter 3, in the aftermath of sin, at verse number 15, we find what many call the initial or the very first prophecy uttered by God concerning a coming deliverer. And in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, we read, "I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." Now that's a tremendous utterance on the part of God and a declaration of His intentions to ultimately provide the remedy for the consequence of sin that Adam and Eve brought upon the human race. Now if we consider that, you come, and again mention with the concept or the idea of the seed mentioned here, just come back over to Genesis 12 once for me, please. Genesis 12, and the first several verses there. Verse 1, "The Lord had said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." Now, we understand that where Abram is concerned, you track this whole thing down to the later chapters in the book of Genesis, and the seed to which he refers must come through Abram and then to Isaac. You all are familiar with the goings-on of the birth of Isaac. From the tremendous way in which God took an old man and an old woman, restored the time of life, and they brought forth this son. to carry on the seed. And if you follow that whole thing through in the Old Testament, from book to book to book, and you come to Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14, to the classic Old Testament verse on the virgin birth, you understand that Isaiah 7, the entire book, was 7 centuries prior to the manger scene at Bethlehem. In Isaiah chapter 7, that reference reads very specifically that there will be a sign. And verse 14, the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive, bear a son, call his name Emmanuel. Now, 700 years down the road, this all happens. Now, God made an utterance. If you account for the number of years that passed between Genesis 3 and the recording Moses made to Isaiah, and then you come to the New Testament section of Galatians in chapter 4, Galatians chapter 4, and you read these words in verse 4. When the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his son, made of a woman, made under the law. So track this, please. Genesis 3:15, Isaiah 7:14, Galatians 4, verse 4. That brings you right back to the fulfillment of the prophecy that's recorded in Matthew chapter 1, verses 22 and 23. All this was fulfilled, says Matthew. And he refers right to Isaiah's prophecy. Now, my point is that when God utters a prophecy, he in effect makes a promise. And if God is not able to keep his word, or if he never intended to keep his word, you have no real hope, because you don't have a God. You don't have a God who is faithful to his word. Now, that brings me to the defense of Israel. And this is just a little bit of a warm-up for what I want to do on Sunday morning. But come to Deuteronomy chapter 4 for a minute. Deuteronomy 4. Deuteronomy, in large part, is a replication of the giving of the law. And may I just point out to you, that I think I might be wrong about this, but I think that Deuteronomy is the only other book in the Old Testament that records verbatim or repeats verbatim Moses' law in the book of Exodus. And the only modification that I know of in the book of Deuteronomy is where he comes to the mention of the Sabbath. And in the book of Deuteronomy, the information given about the Sabbath is enhanced, because in Deuteronomy he explains why the Sabbath keeping is important. And so, to make things fast and simple, it's this way: they were to keep the Sabbath to honor the Creator in Moses' law. When you come to the repetition, it takes a little bit different twist and adds this notion. You honor the Creator, but you honor the Redeemer. What is the one thing that initially posed a problem to Israel in the Old Testament, if it was not the failure on their part due to their chronic idolatry to keep the Sabbath? And what other item other than the Sabbath is linked to the chronology of the captivity when Israel was taken to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar for the 70 years? And then you take beyond that and you calculate the span of time from certain explicit prophecies until the day that Messiah is cut off, and understand that when Daniel talks about the time determined beforehand was 70 weeks of years. All is linked directly to the failure of Israel to keep the Sabbaths. And in failure to do that, honoring their Creator and honoring their Redeemer, their Deliverer. And it is ironic that when you come to Deuteronomy chapter 4, there, without getting into a whole lot of detail, just let me put out at verse 24. Let me have you read there with me. For the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. When thou shalt beget children and children's children, and you shall have remained long in the land, and shall corrupt yourselves and make a graven image or the likeness of anything, and shall do evil in the sight of the Lord thy God to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day. That and here, listen, now I get the point of the replacement theologians when I look at a place like verse 26. That you shall soon utterly perish from off the land whereunto you go over Jordan to possess it. You shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed. Now, I can understand, but I don't agree with them. I do understand when they say Israel has essentially forfeited their right to the land, the blessings, based on what you read here in the book of Deuteronomy and other passages. How many times did Israel not only trample upon Sabbath day requirements, but drifted into idolatry of the worst kinds, running side by side in competition with the reekiest, is that a word? The reekiest pagans of their day. And so they say, well, look, they forfeited it. And now God has transposed all the promises to ancient Israel to the church. And so they can go into the book of Psalms and other places in the Old Testament, and they can read New Testament church polity and church doctrine out of the book of Psalms, because they see no distinction between Israel and the church. They're one and the same. Israel's now pushed off to the side. The church is now God's covenant people. I couldn't disagree more because of what I read here in Deuteronomy 4. It says in verse 27, the Lord shall scatter you among the nations. Has he done that? He does. Not only did he take him to Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar, but since then, the numerous nauseating apostasies on the part of the Jews, has he scattered them all over the globe. Now, you do realize that your president has within his inner circle of advisors two apostate Jews, Rahm Emanuel and his brother Ezekiel, both of them. Don't be surprised at the utter contempt and the borderline hatred that is demonstrated in this administration for the nation of Israel. That's just not political philosophy or pragmatism. That's far deeper than that. Because when you filter it all down, filter it all through, it's a contempt for the Jewish Messiah. And the solutions that God offers in His Word. Barack Hussein Obama can read English like you and I can. And he can read in Genesis chapter 12. And he can understand the boundary lines that God gave ancient Israel. He can understand the unconditional qualities of that covenant. But he, like everybody else, refuses to bow the knee to the Creator, much less any concept of a Redeemer. So you read on down here. That you be left few in number among the heathen. And listen, I believe it's true that everywhere there is a pocket of Jews in any nation, they're always an ethnic minority. Everywhere they go. Everywhere they go, always in a great minority. And then verse 28, there shall you serve gods, the work of men's hands, wood, stone, which neither see nor hear, eat nor smell. But if from thence you shall seek the Lord thy God, thou shalt find him. If thou seek him with all thy heart and with all thy soul, then look very closely at verse 30. When thou art in tribulation. Now, I realize that some on the narrow side will look at the word tribulation in a generic sense and say that means like in the period of the book of Judges. You were up, you were down. You were up, you were down. You were up, you were down. When you were down, you were in tribulation. But this word inserted here, in light of the immediate context, has a far more far downrange outlook, 3,500 years downrange. When thou art in tribulation, all these things are come upon thee, even what? What's the next words? Even in what? The latter days. If, here's where you turn replacement theology on its head in a verse. If thou turn to the Lord thy God and shall be obedient unto His voice, He will not forsake thee, neither destroy thee, nor forget the covenant of thy fathers, which He sware unto them. You know, God made a promise to the fathers. He didn't make it to Benjamin Netanyahu or any of the, or Menachem Begin or Barak, General Barak in Israel. He didn't make the promise to them. He made them to the fathers. And he uttered a prophecy, which is to be equated as a promise. And if God was unable to keep His promise, if all this stuff happened to Israel out of God's control, or worse still, if God never intended to bring Israel into the land permanently, then we have no hope as we sit here tonight. Because if He's not able to bring Israel into the land and keep them there just like He said over and over and over again, He is neither able to bring you to heaven. And He's neither able nor willing to bring you to the judgment and present you blameless and faultless before His holy presence. If He can't do one, I quit now. So when you look at verse number 30, talks about the latter days. Now, you come back, you fast forward into the New Testament, and we are familiar with what is spoken about. Paul's epistle to Timothy said, in the latter days, perilous times shall come. In the latter days. Daniel speaks about that. Look at Daniel chapter 12 for a minute. Daniel 12. And the very first verse. And what he's speaking about right here is the same thing Jeremiah. And by the way, you know, we're talking about essential contemporaries on the same timeline. Daniel, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Habakkuk. Verse 1. At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered. There it is. At that time thy people shall be delivered. The point and the purpose of the 7-year tribulation period, when at last it starts, is twofold major, two major items in purpose. Number one, first and foremost, the point of the tribulation period is to bring judgment upon Israel, unbelieving Israel, to chastise them, to bring them to their knees, so that in the latter part of the tribulation period, when they flee from Jerusalem after the abomination of desolation, God preserves them in the wilderness and they will be saved. There will be natural Jewish and some Gentile human beings who survive the catastrophe of the tribulation and make it all the way through to the end, to the kingdom, and go into the kingdom, and then it's their offspring that will be born to them for that 1,000 years, that will be born with a sin nature, rise up in rebellion against the Lord at the end again. Now, push all that rabbit trail aside and understand this. That Daniel's talking about Jacob's trouble that's recorded or mentioned to us in Jeremiah 30, verse 7. But the promise is, thy people, and this is a prophecy, thy people shall be delivered. You go back to the 9th chapter of this same book for just a minute. 9th chapter of this same book, 24, verse 24. Talks there about the 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. upon thy holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins. That's the point of it for the Jews. The second part of that purpose is to judge and eliminate Gentile rebellion. Remember the curse in Genesis 12? God, and I'm paraphrasing, God said, everybody who blesses you, I will bless. Everybody who curses you, I will curse. Do you realize that when the end comes in the latter days, not one single sovereign nation on the planet will stand with Israel, including your own country? Therefore, they fall under the stipulation of the curse uttered in Genesis chapter 12. Therefore, they fall in line for the judgment in the tribulation like everybody else. Everybody else. That should help us each to put the gas pedal down on the pedal of urgency in ministry. You come over here, it says in verse 25, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto Messiah," and of course that was Nehemiah's day, "unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks, 62 weeks. Now remember, now these are weeks of weeks. Weeks of weeks. Weeks of years. And it says, "The street shall be built again, and the wall," even in what? Even in troublous times. "And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off." That happened officially and formally on Palm Sunday. He's riding in there on the donkey, palms are waving. But there was total rejection on the part of the Jewish leadership and authorities to the Messiah. And all of the prophecies and all of the promises that God had made to Israel from ancient time up to that point, all of that came right to a stop. God said, "Time out for Israel." Their prophetic clock stops right here and now. And what the prophets could not see, what the psalmist could not see, was the intervening period of time called the church age. How in the world do you read the book of Psalms or some of these other prophetic books and see the church materialize in there? You can't possibly. You come to Ephesians chapter 3, and Paul said, "This age in which we now live from Pentecost until the rapture was a mystery hidden from the eyes and the understanding of men beforehand." No possible way David or Jeremiah or any of the others could have possibly seen Pentecost and the aftermath that came. No way that Israel and the church are the same. No way does one replace the other. Israel still has in her hand God's Word to live off of. For any believing Jew, and there are, and listen, when you pray for America, and I hope you do, and you pray for the churches of America, pray for Israel too. Not that the outcome isn't going to change. Israel's going to be judged, but you can pray for the individuals in the land to come to a saving faith in the Messiah before the end comes, and it's coming. It's coming. But it says here that after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood unto the end of the war. Desolations are determined. Then verse 27. He shall confirm the covenant for many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. For the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. So when you come over to the New Testament clarification in Matthew chapter 24, what is it that he's speaking about here in verse number 27? Matthew 24 and verse 15. Timeline now brings us right dead in the middle of the tribulation period to the most severe side of the storm. Matthew 24:15. "When therefore you shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whosoever readeth, let him understand. Then let him that be in Judea flee to the mountains." Now when this happens, the people, listen, the people up to this point in Israel living under a promise or a treaty of a kind that has been in place probably from the beginning of the tribulation, where somebody has guaranteed their security. And what is it that they are calling upon Israel to do today? Iran, if you want Iran to disarm and to step back from their nuclear program, you give up your nukes. All 200 and... how many? I can't remember what the number they have in stock. You want them to give them up? You give them up. And of course, follow our example. I mean, the Russians, who are notorious promise keepers, we signed a nuclear reduction treaty with them. So take our example. Follow our lead. Sort of like the old swampland sale in Florida. But these people have been living up to this point in the tribulation under a pseudo-peace. And when the covenant promise is broken and the abomination of desolation is there and the temple that has been rebuilt, which, by the way, it hasn't been yet, when the temple is, they can't figure out what piece of real estate they want to do it on, and after they get it up, who's going to own it? But anyhow, once that's rebuilt, it'll be desecrated, and that then signals the release. And somebody asked me this afternoon about, well, who do you think was those who was fleeing into the wilderness? And my opinion is, humbly given, is it is those who have come to a saving knowledge of Christ, the Messiah. And they flee to the wilderness. They get out of town for their survival sake. For you see, to name the name of Christ in this time era means almost certain martyrdom. What happens to them who flee from their natural comfort zone? What happens? Three things, and then we'll quit. First of all, see the divine protection. Revelation 12. Verse 6. Understanding the nature of dual status in prophetic passages, understand this much. Yet future, the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God that she... that they should feed her there 1,260 days. If you count it up, it's exactly the 3.5. Now, if you put that together with other places, you can see also divine preparation. Go back to Zechariah chapter 12 just for a minute. Zechariah 12. And would you please look at verse number 10? Zechariah 12:10. Divine preparation now. I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications, and they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him. That's why I make the contention that those who fleeing in that day have been made the primary beneficiaries of the work of the Spirit. They shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. You remember what their reaction was at Calvary? You remember what the Jews' reaction was there? They spit on him, they mocked him, they jeered him, they taunted him, they insulted him. Not here. In that day shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem. Why? Because it's being sacked. The temple's desecrated. So there's divine protection. And then what's God's intention? You come back to Romans chapter 11. Romans 11. Verse number 25 and 26. What's God's intention? For I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part, and that's what, you know, do you talk about grace? There it is. You know, did you stop by to see the display table of this young couple I say young couple, relatively speaking, that going to be ministering to the Jewish community in New York City, in the Bronx. They go because of these two words in verse number 25, in part. Because if those aren't there and blindness entirely has fallen upon Israel, then none of the Jews, none of the ethnic pure blood Jews have the possibility of being saved. My opinion. But the blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles come in. And so all Israel, promise now, based on everything we've seen from Genesis 3:15 to Isaiah 7:14 to Galatians 4:4 to Matthew chapter 1 verse 22, all those other utterances of prophecy are in effect promises. And he said, all Israel shall be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. When is he going to do that? Right there at the end of the tribulation period. Right at the end. Divine promise. Come back, please, to Matthew chapter 24. Now, there are scattering. They're scattered all over the planet. It might surprise you to learn that while there has been a large migration of ethnic Jews to the Promised Land, that there are other pockets of Jews, I think particularly in the East Coast, in the United States of America, and other places where the population of the Jews is greater there than in the Promised Land. However, in Matthew 24 and verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven unto the other. Great poetic but very precise promise that none for whom Christ died shall perish, that no matter where on the globe they are at that time and at that moment in history, he will gather them there to their land. They're not getting dumped out of the land. They're coming back to the land. Now, why would he do that? Do you realize that Israel historically is the only nation that has ever existed, the only nation that God has ever taken them out of one nation to establish another nation? The only one. Why would he do that? Well, come back to where we started. One last verse, Deuteronomy chapter 4. Link, please. Deuteronomy 4, verse 30, where we started with verse number 37, and you get the answer to that question. Deuteronomy 4, because it basically is the same answer to the same question on your behalf. Deuteronomy 4, verse number 37. Why did he make an exception of Israel? Why would he pick one people to bless numerically and to use that one people to be the conduit by which the Word of God would become into the world, and through this particular nation, the Messiah himself would come? Simply said in verse 37, because he loved thy fathers. Does that astound you? Looking for a more scientific, complex, are you looking for a more acceptable answer? I like things simple. And here it is. He loved thy fathers. Therefore he chose their seed after them and brought thee out in his sight with his mighty power out of Egypt. The only nation on the planet that he ever did that for. Because he loved them. Why? Why did he extract you from Egypt, so to speak? Because he saw that you would grow into mature, handsome, beautiful men and women, intellectually astute, always faithful, big-hearted and always generous. Don't smoke, don't drink, don't chew, don't go with girls and guys who do. Therefore, he set his loving arm around you. Is that the way it is? No. He loved you. And I have no clue, speak for yourself, but I have no clue for me why. There's grace. Just grace. Would you pray with me, please?